Mr. Adamson, Reel 3. Can you tell me about other aspects of the searchlight, the equipment?
Well, apart from the mirror cleaning, the obvious thing to be maintained and changed from time to time because they used to wear down were the carbon sticks, and they had to be changed, which there was a positive and a negative of carbon, and obviously they went in their appropriate position. We used to have to change the carbon from time to time. We maintained that we always had a reasonable stock. Should you have to change, you could possibly be in the middle of either an exercise or probably detecting enemy aircraft, and you would find that your carbons had worn down and the searchlight was giving you an inferior beam. So consequently, you had to shoot down. There was also on the top of the searchlight, there was an extractor fan which took the fumes away from inside. But what it didn't always do was dissipate the heat that would be created by the carbon arcing during the searchlight when it was lit. So quite often, and unfortunately, you always had to make sure that at the start of an evening, when the searchlight would become useful, that in fact you did make sure that your carbons were long enough to be able to sustain a fair amount of illumination. They had to change them quite sometimes during either an exercise or when enemy aircraft were in the vicinity. So you had to change them, but what you had to do is you had to wait till some of the heat within the searchlight had dissipated. You used to leave the fan running to try to extract as much of the heat as possible. But quite often all the components inside were quite hot. So it wasn't unusual to finish up with your fingers getting burnt.
So maintenance must have been a major part of your work.
Basically, yes. It was something I became interested in, and later on, as the progression was made in the design of searchlights, I became even more interested because a lot of radar-controlled equipment came in later on.
What was the intensity of the beam, you know, in the sense of power and distance and so forth?
That, I'm afraid, that I couldn't tell. It was millions of candle power, and that was the way the illumination was assessed. Offhand, I would have to go back to an old handbook or something like that.
Now, you joined in January of 1939. Were there signs that war was coming at that point in time?
Yes, because there'd also been a called up, an emergency in 1938. They were called up, I wasn't in at that particular time, but there'd been a call up in 1938. Now, I don't know whether they were on standby for a fortnight or longer, and then the emergency sort of disappeared and they were stood down. But yes, I don't think that was uppermost in my mind when I joined, otherwise probably I would have thought twice about it. But I joined basically as an escape from evening classes.
Again, coming back to the signs of the war approaching in those months leading up to September, I'm thinking in terms of the normal living life of people around you. Were there signs that, for example, of Anderson shelters or this kind of thing coming along over those months?
No, not
gas masks.
Not to the best of my knowledge. We did a month's camp in the August of 1939, and I went away, I think, it was the 12 days before war started.
Where was the camp?
We went to a field adjoining the Territorial Army Drill Hall in Gisborough. When I say that the signs of war weren't imminent, at the time that we were doing the month's camp in the August of 1939, also just within a few miles from where we were, there was a purpose-built military camp built at a place called Hutton Gate. And as a matter of fact, after war was eventually declared, we were sent to Hutton Gate. But at that particular time, I didn't know about this Hutton Gate camp. So, yes, there were signs of which I was ignorant. There were signs that war was imminent because these camps obviously must have been being built in various parts of the country with this sort of a situation in view. But I was doing drills down at the drill hall.
I was going to ask you about just what military drills you did other than searchlight drills.
We used to go, you were obliged to qualify for what you call your bounty in those days. You were obliged to do so many drills over the period of a year and then attend a camp. In some cases it had previously been a fortnight and then it was extended to a month. So yes, I attended those drills twice a week, which I used to enjoy.
Was marching drill and slow and weapon drill part of that?
Yes, you were instructed in the use of the Shortley Enfield rifle. You were instructed in bayonet drill. You were instructed in basic marching, saluting, marking time and so forth, forming fours as it was in those days, and the various army drills that were applicable to the army in those days. It's not something that I didn't detest. In some respects, the drilling, at 17-year-old, it was something of a new expedition for me altogether. Not being involved in that sort of environment, apart from my short years in the St. John's Ambulance Brigade, marching wasn't sort of instilled to me as a kiddie. But yes, I did enjoy the drills, and then eventually was called up for a month's camp.
What was the usual or normal civilian attitude towards territorial soldiers? Were you looked upon in a serious way? Or?
The general term to people like myself in those days were you were called Saturnite soldiers. But I don't think anybody looked down upon them as inferior, and I'm sure that later on when the war started people appreciated that the Territorial Army was there.
But you said you went to camp for a month and that was no problem getting off work?
The company I worked for had a very good understanding with anybody that was in Territorial units. I know quite a few people within the company I worked for, especially the Central Marine Engine Works, that were in fact Territorial Army soldiers, so that when they went away, and of course these camps were staggered, my camp wasn't the same as say the heavy battery or the medium battery, so the people weren't all at work at the same time, they were staggered. And they went to their own various areas of camp. I believe the heavy battery went somewhere down into Wales to do their practice shooting and things like that. So, no, there wasn't a problem. When I eventually was informed that I would be away for such and such a period of time, I was left to go without any qualms whatsoever.
What was the bounty? Do you recall?
I think it was £100, I'm not sure. It was quite a substantial amount of money. And of course you were also paid on the amount of drills that you qualified for. You used to get a small amount, I forget what the amount was, but you also got your drill money. So attending the two nights a week was an amount of money in excess of what I was getting as an apprentice, so that was extra pocket money. So
it was pretty good wage, if that's what you can call it, at that time.
Yes.
Do you recall where you were and what you were doing when Chamberlain made the announcement?
Yes, I was already mobilised.
When had that happened? When were you called?
if I can just wear back through dates, September the 3rd was on a Sunday. I returned back from camp after a month's camp on, I think it was the 17th. I returned back from camp, I think it was on the 17th of August 1939. That was after a month's camp. We started in July, and it ran through into the 17th of August. I returned to work on the Monday, which would be the 19th of August, and on the 24th of August, the engineer in charge of the department I work for approached me and he said, "Adamson, you are in the Territorial Army, 2nd 5th Battalion." I said, "Yes, sir." Incidentally, this gentleman was also an officer in the First World War. And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, you're being mobilised, return home, pack your kit, and return to the, and go down to the drill hall." So I came back home, packed my kit, put my uniform on, and went down to the drill hall. And that was on Thursday, the 24th of August. And I immediately stopped in the drill hall for, I think, probably, at the most, a few hours. And then we were packed onto trucks, on the back of army trucks, and the whole of the company was deployed to this field adjoining the drill hall in Guilsborough. And once we were on this field in tents, and then the militia barracks at Hutton Gate Camp was then finished and made available, and we left the field and went into the barrack buildings in there. So on the 3rd of September, when war was actually declared, I was in the army. I'd already been back in for approximately 10 days.
What did you feel like? I mean, this is the real thing.
I had been moved back from the barracks at Hutton Gate Camp. I'd been moved back from there due to a slight indiscipline on my part. And I'd been moved back to regimental headquarters, which was fortunately, or unfortunately, whichever way you look at it, it was in the armory in Avenue Road, in Hartlepool, which incidentally was roughly about 400 or 500 yards from where I lived. So on the 3rd of the war was declared, I was able to go back round home and inform my parents that war, well, my father, that war had been declared. And I was returning back to my barracks, and that was the end of it. And subsequently from there, it was just, I don't know whether I approached the news with any apprehension of any kind. I just sort of accepted it. And at 17 and a half year old, which I was by then, it just didn't bother me. I think the only thing I thought, well, what about my apprenticeship? I think I was more concerned about my apprenticeship at that particular time.
What was your father's reaction that his son was now in the
army? I think the fact that he'd spent the years in the First World War, I don't think he was too bothered too much. And the fact that it, at that particular age, at 17 and a half, I was pretty safe that, well, in fact, at that particular time, people weren't even thinking of going to France then. Not immediately. It was some time after the people started to go over to France in the September and the October and things like that.
Well, you were back at regimental headquarters. What happened to you then?
I was subjected to an amount of discipline by the senior NCOs and the regimental sergeant majors.
What had you done to deserve this?
The sergeant majors parade first thing in the morning. I turned out. In those days, there were no blouses. You had the ordinary tunics with brass buttons. And unfortunately, on that particular morning, it was a fairly damp morning, and the buttons on my tunic and also the buckle on my belt were subject to the weather, and they didn't have a shine on them. And the NCO in charge of the parade took exception to this, and I was brought before the CO and was told I would have to report back to regimental headquarters, which, strange enough, was more of a bonus to me than a punishment, being as I lived at Hartlepool and it was only 400 or 500 yards from where I lived.
And what was the punishment you were saying?
It was just a case of you had to parade on a morning, your buttons had to be bright, your cap badge had to be bright, the buckle of your belt had to be nice and bright. And at 17-year-old, I was suddenly brought into line and realised what discipline was, which, due to my lifestyle, I'd never been subjected to discipline. As a kiddie, in the way I'd been brought up as just my father and myself, I was left to a lot of my own devices. And then suddenly the whip was cracked and I had to start jumping.
And thereafter, were you able to take discipline and
no
problems?
Oh, yes. I found discipline was something that I benefited from later on in life. Later on in life, I started to imply discipline to other people. And I realised that to be able to imply it, you had to be able to accept it in the first place. And I found that my early days in army life were a foundation for what I got later on in life.
You were turned an immature in the army,
oh, yes.
Under 18.
Yes. We were classed as immatures. In fact, that's what the regiment, when some of the senior members of the company and other companies besides the company I was in were suddenly extracted from that company to form, I think it was called the BEF in those days, when they went over to France. And several of the people I knew out from in Hartlepool that went over there actually lost their lives with the BEF in France, unfortunately. But then the gaps that were left by those people that were taken away were filled by people from regiments, such as an ordinary infantry regiment, where people were like myself, were under 18, and in those days they didn't send them abroad under 18-year-olds. So those people were eventually sent in to fill the gaps, and the regiments became, and the companies became companies and regiments of immatures.
Do you remember where these people were coming from?
Oh, from all walks. When I tell you that the company I was in eventually was formed with people from regiments from over the border, the HLI, the Border Regiment, the Coileys, the Cosbys, the North and South Staffordshire Regiment, the Cheshire Regiment. I think I could go on and on and on where these people come from, but these were all people like myself, under 18-year-old, who were too young to go with their own regiments to go abroad, and they were deployed into anti-aircraft regiments, such as searchlights and medium anti-aircraft and things like that.
And how did they settle into a different regiment, different unit?
Because they were all of the same age, I think we all had the same sort of narrow outlook, and that was self-survival. But I met and made some very, very good friends over the years from various regiments, from Scotchmen to Yorkshiremen, and in particular, later on, I met and made a very good friend out of a young man that was called up in those days, was what they called the 21 Militia, which was, I think, was the 1939, I think, was the first call-up of people that were 21-year-old, and they were called up, I think, was for a year, and they did. They went into the militia, and they were known as the 21 Militia in those days. And I met and befriended a chap which was a couple of years or more older than myself, and we became very, very good friends later on. But at 17 and a half year old in 1939, say the September and October and onward, the regiments changed completely. The only thing that didn't change enough quite often was all the senior NCOs of the Searchlight regiments as such. And they were still there. They were the foundation and the backbone of the companies in those days. And they were there to, what shall I say, manipulate and train all the 17-and-a-half-year-olds that were suddenly underneath their command, you see.
Do you remember your particular NCOs at this point in time?
Yes, quite a few of them, actually. One or two I remember with rather adverse recollections, but nevertheless, most of them, and I met over the years and years to come after the war finished, those that managed to survive, and we come into contact with each other. Yes.
And which particular ones do you recall? I mean, we're talking about these early days. You know,
in particular, there was one in particular, a lad called Cyril Wilkinson. I didn't know in those days he was also called Stanley, and it was only later on in life that I realised that he answered to the name of Stanley, but we knew him as Cyril, and Cyril was probably a year or so older than I was. He was a tall lad, very slim, very smart, and at about 18 year old, he became a Lance Sergeant, which was very good for a lad of that age. And Sidlin and I became very, very good friends, but unfortunately later on, when I partnered with the company, Sidlin moved with that company, and eventually became Regimental Sergeant Major of his own light anti-aircraft regiment, 113. But Cyril and I were very, very good friends. And later on in life, the roles became reversed, because he eventually came to work for the company I worked for, and he was just a general labourer. And by this time, I was a foreman, I was a supervisor. And of course, the roles eventually became reversed, and Cyril and I, and he always used to call me Mr. Adamson. So the roles from me calling him Sir to him calling Mr. Adamson suddenly reversed. But Cyril and I were very, very good friends. And unfortunately, he died quite a few years ago now.
But and are there any other NCOs that you recall that were with your unit, your particular unit?
Not really, not in particular, I think.
Detachment sergeants or anyone of that nature?
Yes, there were detachment sergeants. One detachment I was in particular. For the life of me, I can't remember his second name, his surname. But he was a Cockney. But he lived in the town and he worked in the town. He was a Territorial Army sergeant. And I was on detachment with him. He was quite a nice, quite a friendly, fatherly type of NCO. Quite a nice chap. And I met him many years later, after the war was over. And he still had the same attitude. And another sergeant, once again, was of the fatherly type, Sergeant Jeffries. He was a...
Well, he's a good age, but much older.
Oh, yes, yes, he was a lot older than I am. Sergeant Jeffries, he was always smoked a pipe, and people used to refer to him. They didn't call him Sergeant Jeffries. They used to say, "Have you seen Sergeant Pipe?" But him and I became very good friends later on in life after the war was over.
They treated you pretty well, did they?
Oh yes.
Any amongst those NCOs that you know, were difficult to get on with or didn't treat
one
you correctly?
One in particular, actually. One NCO in particular. And rather remarkable, because later on in life when I married, he lived under the corner of the street where my in-laws lived. But I always had reservations about him, even after the war. But during the war, he was a very, very hard man, actually. And the unfortunate part about it was he also had a brother who was slightly older than him. And the brother was of a completely different nature.
When you say hard, in what way?
I think it was hard more on people like myself, a 17-and-a-half-year-old, who considered us to be totally inferior. He was a married man. He had family of his own, so why he should have adopted this sort of attitude, I don't know. But not only myself, he was people of my age. He was he had the same sort of attitude.
What was his name? Do you remember his name?
Dennis, Sergeant Dennis. Stevie, Stephen Dennis.
Were there quite a number of, we've mentioned officers and NCOs, were quite a number of them First World War people of that age and experience with the battery?
Yes.
Quite a number of them.
Yes.
There must have been quite a gap between the quite old NCOs and quite young ones.
Oh, yes, there was, because I think when the people start to leave and the images were brought in, I think there was a need to promote some of the more acceptable prospective NCOs out of the private ranks and take them up into as junior NCOs, and they were the people that made progress. Going back to what we said early on about the territorial decoration, there was one NCO in particular. I think he worked for an insurance company, and he was a Lance Corporal. He finished up eventually in Austria as a major, and after the war there was a detachment of the Royal Military Police formed in Hartlepool, and he eventually became a Lieutenant Colonel over that same regiment. Unfortunately, that same gentleman, for the want of a better word, died a few years ago. But when I saw him in a particular situation, I was rather amazed at the deterioration in the man's health. But nevertheless, that man went from Lance Corporal up to a Lieutenant Colonel, even though it be Territorial Army. But, yeah, there were officers, there was GAPS, there was NCOs. But the senior NCOs of the company that I was in, I think they were the fatherly type. You could talk to them and they would talk to you. There was the odd exception, and I'm afraid that Stephen Dennis was one of them. That's